This is CME on ReachMD. This activity, titled Advancing Interdisciplinary Care in Prostate Cancer, Clinical Updates for Urology and Oncology Healthcare Professional, is provided by Access Medical Education and supported by an educational grant from Sanofi Genzyme. Prior to beginning the activity, please be sure to review the faculty information and conflict of interest disclosure statements, as well as the learning objectives by visiting reachmd.com/accessmeded.
Hi, I'm Oliver Sartor, and it's my pleasure today to help give you an update on advanced prostate cancer and some of the new concepts that we've been exploring, some of the new data that I think are impactful. And it's quite interesting. We used to sort of think about prostate cancer in terms of surgery, radiation, hormonal therapy, and chemotherapy. But we're beginning to introduce new concepts. In particular, the targeted therapies are being explored in clinical trials. Immunotherapy, new novel immunotherapy is being explored in clinical trials. We're looking at nuclear medicine in all new ways, both in terms of diagnostics as well as treatment. And we're looking at molecular and genetic testing and genetic counseling in a whole new way as well. So the repertoire of skill sets required to take care of these advanced patients is expanding. When we look at the patients with prostate cancer, we can broadly divide them into different disease states. And there's a lot of ways to divide this. And I'm going to be starting by talking about the metastatic disease set. And it's quite interesting that we now have DNA repair gene mutations that are much more commonly found than what was previously anticipated. Almost 12% of men with metastatic prostate cancer will have DNA repair gene mutation, most common of which is BRCA2. Other common ones include CHEK2, ATM, BRCA1, RAF51D, PALB2. And there's definitely a higher incidence of these alterations within men with metastatic disease as compared to localized disease. So why are these germline mutations important? This is inherited DNA, and there are a couple of things that I'd like to bring out. Number one is these patients have a poor prognosis overall. They have an earlier age of onset. They're more likely to be diagnosed with metastatic disease. It has implications for future treatments. Today we have PARP inhibitors that can target some of the DNA repair defects, platinum perhaps, and PD-1 inhibitors for mismatch repair, and tomorrow there may be much more. There are implications for family members that may need increased monitoring at an earlier age and possibly even prophylactic intervention, particularly for women where prophylactic mastectomy, prophylactic oophorectomy are indicated in a substantial number of women who might have high-risk mutations such as BRCA1, BRCA2. There are a lot of issues that we don't know. Various ethnic populations are, of course, relatively unstudied. Mainly what we have today in the current data sets are European-centric populations. So when we begin to look at these individuals with metastatic disease, understanding that they may be influenced by certain mutations, such as DNA repair, what about therapy? And we have some newer data with therapy I'd like to cover with you today. I kind of titled this next section in terms of consensus and controversy and change. Known from the charted studies and the first Stampede reports that high-volume metastatic disease is suitable for ADT and 6 cycles of docetaxel. And I think we have a lot of consensus on that point. But we do have controversy in those individuals with low-volume metastatic disease. And that's simply because we have data from Charted that shows no survival benefit. And on the other hand, we have data from Stampede that is somewhat agnostic with regards to higher or low volume. Stampede guys just say metastasis is appropriate for 6 cycles of docetaxel, but that is not the case from the charted studies to date. But what's new is that we have the Latitude and the new Stampede, and these were presented at ASCO 2017 with ADT plus or minus abiraterone and simultaneously published in the New England Journal of Medicine. If we look at the Latitude study, and these were typically people who had bony metastatic disease in combination with a high Gleason score, that was the most typical entry criteria. You look at overall survival, there's absolutely no question that the addition of abiraterone can improve the overall survival relative to placebo, and that would be plus ADT, so everybody got ADT. The radiographic progression-free survival was also improved with ADT plus abiraterone as compared to placebo plus ADT, and the data shown here really emphasize that point. One of the things that was to me a little bit surprising was the degree of improvement in the PSA progression. If you look at conventional ADT in this population, admittedly a pretty tough population to treat, the median time to PSA progression was about 8 months in the regular ADT arm plus placebo, but with abiraterone, it was stretched out to the 34-month range. So this is really a tremendous difference with a hazard ratio of 0.3. Look at the adverse events. I think they're the same adverse events that we would have been associating with the abiraterone and prednisone in the more advanced studies, such as Cougar 301 and 302. There's some hypertension, hypokalemia, and some liver function changes being the predominant issues, and those definitely are things that you need to be monitoring when you're treating these patients. Interestingly, I'll point out that in the Latitude studies, they were using only 5 milligrams of prednisone, not the 5 BID that has been used in Cougar 301 and 302. Now, the data from Stampede is also very, very similar, showing in the metastatic patients an improvement in overall survival and failure-free survival, which included PSA progression, clearly very, very distinct between the ADT plus abiraterone arms versus the ADT alone arms. So that's, again, data that I think you can take to the bank. With regard to the overall survival in non-metastatic disease, there's really no question that the overall survival has a favorable trend, but it's too early to really make a call. These are non-statistically significant changes. The failure-free survival, however, does show a strong benefit, and whether or not that'll translate into improvements in survival will require more time and study. So what are the implications of the Latitude and New Stampede? I think that up front, abiraterone and prednisone are going to be appropriate for standard of care, but I think it can change the biology of the tumor. What we call castrate-resistant disease is going to be a new castrate-resistant disease, because when you treat with ADT abiraterone, it's going to be different than just ADT alone. There are going to be cross-resistance that is going to be an issue here. We already know about the strong cross-resistance between abiraterone and enzalutamide in advanced disease, and I think it'll hold here as well. It really changes what we mean about CRPC. You know, castrate-resistant prostate cancer has sort of been a monolithic variety where it's just post-ADT. But now we have to define what type of CRPC we're treating. Is it just post-ADT? Is it post-ADT docetaxel or post-ADT abiraterone prednisone? So there's, again, perhaps a little bit of controversy over what might be appropriate. I'm sure you're aware that docetaxel is now a generic drug. Abiraterone is not. It's hard to know from a cost perspective over which one is better, but we do have the ESMO 2017 data, which indicates that the overall survival is the same for docetaxel and abiraterone, and whether or not the 6 cycles of chemotherapy are the abiraterone until progression ought to be used, I think ought to be left to individual decision-making, and in many cases the cost will drive people into docetaxel. Now, one of the things that's been quite commonly detected now as we move into more scanning with the novel nuclear medicine agents, and this could be things like choline, it could be PSMA PET, it could be fluciclovine PET, and I'm not covering all of those here just from limitations of time, but the new nuclear medicine imaging is important. We're defining more and more patients with oligometastatic disease, meaning just a few areas of metastases, And how do we treat those patients is really becoming very controversial. And first of all, I'll start off by saying that nobody really knows the right answers. A lot of times we're using stereotactic body radiotherapy or SBRT to the metastases, and that may delay systemic therapy. You can use kind of old ADT, which is the testicular suppression alone, or maybe the new ADT, which may involve abiraterone, but there are controversies over which one you should use and how long. Should you be using combinations of ADT and SBRT? And some people may even argue about docetaxel, or maybe you ought to do all the above, but of course we don't have data for that. What I'll say is that we have something for almost every predilection. We have a true dealer's choice, but we have no comparative trials, so we don't really know the right answer. And I'll say it depends on the goals, importantly. So next, I'd like to go into the metastatic CRPC setting, which is a setting that involves a lot of deaths each year in the United States. It's about 26,000 deaths. It's a second leading cause of cancer, third leading cause of cancer death in American men, with lung cancer and colon cancer being slightly more prevalent. We have a lot of trials that have been ongoing in this space, and I don't mean to cover them, but starting off with TAX-327, SWOG-9916, and with the docetaxel data, the impact data with SipluCell-T, Cougar-302, 301, Prevail, Tropic, Affirm, Alcimca, and each of these trials have been done in a particular space, either the previously chemotherapy naive, the post-docetaxel space, or a combination like Alcimca. So there's really a lot of data out there, but at the same time, there's a lot of things that we don't know. And among the things we don't know are what I call sequencing and combinations and molecular biomarkers, and I'm going to label these as the great unknowns. If you look at the NCCN guidelines, we have a variety of choices in terms of first-line therapy. We have a variety of choices after progression on abiraterone or enzalutamide. We have a variety of choices after progression on docetaxel. And you can see within the NCCN guidelines large listings that, quite frankly, are not particularly helpful for the physicians. There are no comparative trials. There are no real combination trials that have been reported to date. And so we're stuck with sort of questions over how should we manage these patients. Now, what I'll say is that when we look at sequential therapies, we do actually have a lot of data about what happens post-docetaxel. And there we have FDA approvals for abiraterone, enzalutamide, cabazitaxel, and radium. But again, no level one evidence for comparing these particular agents to one another. And so that leaves us with a bit of a conundrum. So what are some of the considerations? You know, number one, there are many articles that can be cited, but I'll say that there's huge cross-resistance between abiraterone and enzalutamide when used sequentially. Whichever you use first will likely last a while. Whichever one you use second is not going to be a treatment that lasts very long. And you're always going to have a better chance of having a lasting response with your first line as opposed to your second line AR inhibitor therapy. In fact, as I'll even go so far to say, is that back-to-back hormonal agents might not be the best option. Particularly if you're using enzalutamide first, going to abiraterone, the response rate is extremely low. If you go from abiraterone first, enzalutamide second, you do have a little higher response rate, but rarely are those responses durable. So what about chemotherapy here? And I'll quote data from the Cougar 302 trial where they looked at docetaxel post-abiraterone. About 40% of the patients had a PSA decline of 50% or more. If you look at the third-generation cabazitaxel, here there's some interesting data with docetaxel first, then abiraterone, followed by cabazitaxel. And here you end up with a PSA response rate of about 35%, medium OS about 14.3%. And that compares very favorably to the TROPIC study, which was just post-docetaxel with a PSA decline rate of greater than 50%. of around 39% of patients. And it would appear that cabazitaxel does seem to retain activity in this third-line setting. And that is an interesting finding. There may be a little less cross-resistance with cabazitaxel. Now, what about comparing cabazitaxel to docetaxel in the first-line metastatic setting? And what I'll say is that there is a cabazitaxel trial, and this was very recently published by Stefan Uddard and colleagues in JCO, looking at two doses of docetaxel versus the conventional 75 milligrams per meter squared. Two doses of cabazitaxel versus the conventional dosing of docetaxel. And it turns out that the median survival was really no different among the various arms. And you can see here on this slide from the first ANA trial that the survival in terms of median was 24.5, 25.2, 24.3 for the various arms. And there really were no differences in survival. There were, however, some differences in the adverse event ratio with having some less neuropathy, a little less alopecia, perhaps less edema associated with cabazitaxel. So there were some different toxicity profiles. There was a second trial that I think is important, and this is a practice-changing trial, Prosilica, showing that a slightly reduced dose of cabazitaxel, 20 milligrams per meter squared, was non-inferior to 25 milligrams per meter squared. The overall median OS was no different, 13.4 versus 14.5 months in these patients with cabazitaxel post-docetaxel. And it turns out that, in my opinion, this is a little better tolerated therapy and one that can be used in practice given the non-inferiority for OS. There was less myelosuppression, less infections that were occurring at the slightly lower dose. And the FDA has now approved this 20 milligrams per meter squared of cabazitaxel. What about biomarkers and molecular stratification? What I'll say is that the V7 variant of androgen receptor has gotten a lot of publicity coming from the Hopkins Group, New England Journal back in 2017, being able to classify people, you know, perfectly by ARV7 measurements into resistant or sensitive patients, particularly the resistant patients. But that is not held up in a perfect manner, but nevertheless, it is important. ARV7 is a splice variant of androgen receptor that translates into a receptor that has a deletion of the ligand binding domain, but it still binds DNA and stimulates transcription. So it's something that is quite problematic. And if you look here at the measurement of ARV7 CTCs from the Epic Biosciences group, what you can see is that there is an accumulation of ARV7 in resistant patients to second or third line therapy with androgen receptor signaling inhibitors such as abiraterone and enzalutamide. But these are very rare in the first line, so they typically are associated with resistant pattern. Interestingly, however, when we look at taxane responsiveness, taxanes are not really sensitive to the ARV7. So if you have the ARV7 or not, it turns out pretty much to be the same. If we look at another data set, this is from the Royal Marsden, they're looking at androgen receptor amplification from circulating free DNA are certain androgen receptor mutants, particularly the 702 and the 878 mutant. And what I'll say is that you can see that there's an accumulation of these mutants in patients that are resistant to abiraterone. And if you are having one of these mutations or copy number gains, you're more likely to be resistant. So that's an important finding as well, particularly since the circulating free DNA is starting to be more and more available. I'll also say that overall survival of a study from the Royal Marsden indicates that if you do have an AR androgen receptor aberrancy, and in this particular case it's the 702 mutation, the 878 mutation are the copy number gain, that your survival is much shorter in an abiraterone-treated patient populations. So how do we get to this kind of new era where we choose the right drug for the right patient at the right time, sort of our precision medicine approach? We need to really have some positive selection parameters, and we have that, we believe, but we need to prove it in more clinical trials. So DNA repair defects can be inherited, somatic, or both. Already covered some of the inherited mutations. I mentioned the DNA repair pathway, particularly BRCA2. And it turns out that PARP inhibitors seem to be preferentially effective in those with DNA repair defects. A small trial suggested benefit in 14 out of 16 patients. Clearly, this needs to be expanded. Clearly, this needs to be done in a multi-center fashion. But at the same time, the PARP inhibitors do look promising for those with DNA repair defects, particularly the BRCA1, BRCA2, and ATMs. Now, what about alternatives? Well, we do have platinum sensitivity demonstrated for those with allelic BRCA2 alterations. And there's been some very small studies showing that the combination of docetaxel and platinum patients would have a favorable clinical course, particularly if they had BRCA2 alterations. There's data with cabazitaxel and carboplatin used with G-CSF, I might add, and aggressive variants of prostate cancer. These are with liver metastases, high LDH, a variety of sort of criteria went into aggressive variants. It's kind of 7 different criteria, not all of which are sort of widely accepted. But lytic lesions, low PSA, liver metastases, high LDH. And it looks like that a cabazitaxel is better than a cabazitaxel regimen alone. We still need more data here. We still need prospective analysis. And so there's going to be more to the story. What about the new immunotherapies? And pembrolizumab is one that is an important new immunotherapy, a PD-1 inhibitor similar to nivolumab. And what I'll say is that there's been some initial data suggesting that pembrolizumab may be a quite active agent in a subset. We're still struggling to sort of define the subset. Some of these seem to have the MSI high or mismatch repair alteration that we associate with PD-1 sensitivity, but not all patients do. So this is going to have to be more exploratory. It is important to note that the response rate here is probably in the 10% range for meaningful responses, probably not higher than 20, but again, we need clinical trials to be able to define this further, because right now it's an area of lots of exploration. What about PTEN loss? This is one of the more common genetic factors that is associated with advanced prostate cancer. Now, this is a somatic mutation or alteration or deletion, not a germline. And it turns out that an AKT inhibitor, ipatasertib, has been found in preliminary trials to have activity. This is now being explored in larger phase 3 trials. And the p-value for those with PTEN loss is significant, whereas the p-value for those without PTEN loss is not. So this is maybe another attempt at precision medicine with AKT inhibitors in the PTEN loss subset. So when we look at another thing that is quite interesting, we note that PSMA, which is prostate-specific membrane antigen, gets upregulated, and there is some preclinical data, not clinical data, preclinical data that demonstrates that you may have synergy when enzalutamide or abiraterone are combined with PSMA-targeted therapy. This needs to be proven in the clinic. But we do have some preliminary activity coming from a variety, particularly German sources, Australian sources, about PSMA lutetium-177 and the activity for waterfall plots, as shown on the PSA response rate here, can be quite impressive for some. So in summary, you know, what we have is a CRPC that we've been able to treat with hormones and radiopharmaceuticals and chemotherapies and immunotherapies like Cyclosel T in the past. It's evolving into a little more molecularly targeted disease. There's no question that AR remains probably the most important target, but we still have a lot of exploration to go. I want to emphasize that taxanes still have a very important role to play. They can work even in the context of prior abiraterone and enzalutamide exposure. And what I'll say is that we have made a great deal of progress over the last several years, but there's so much more progress that we need to make. And that's going to be up to the clinical investigators and individuals who will be pushing these therapies forward over the next few years. So thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be able to present this update on advanced prostate cancer today. I'm Oliver Sartor.
This has been CME on ReachMD. This activity was provided by Access Medical Education. To receive your free CME credit or to download this activity, go to ReachMD.com/AccessMedEd. Thank you for joining us.